Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our session. The topic for our discussion today, as you can see, everybody can see the board okay? Can see the slide presentation? Is on the topic of uterus transplantation. How many people here have actually had a uterus transplant? Anybody? So some of the men raised their hand. We will see, actually, that that's not so crazy as we see towards the end of our presentation. So some of you may have heard about the recent advances in medicine and science and transplantation, which have actually allowed uterus transplantation to take place. We are going to get to that towards the end of my remarks. I have this chus of sharing the podium today with Rabbi Shaul Rappaport. We will together be speaking about the topic of uterus transplant and maternity. And what I'm going to be talking about is the following. Here's the brief outline for our discussion. We're going to be talking about uterine transplantation in the Bible, and I put in parentheses, this is not a misprint. The second thing we'll be talking about is the case of uterine transplantation that never was. And our third section will be modern uterine transplantation. So we begin with the first case in history of uterus transplantation, and that is none other than Sarah Imenu. Now you're all familiar with the fact that Sarah suffered from infertility. There's actually different midrashim as to what exactly was the nature of her infertility. So the first discussion in the one discussion in the midrashim, it says the Avram v'Sarah zkenim bayim bayamim. They were both elderly. Chadal iyos v'Sarah orach kanoshim. Sarah did not have a menstrual cycle, and Rashi says paskami menu orach nidus. She was menopausal. So obviously, in pre-modern times, because she was menopausal, she couldn't have children. The second line in the Medrash is Vatihi Sarah Akara Ein La Valad. What does it mean, Ein La Valad? So the simple interpretation of Ein La Valad means she didn't have a Vlad or a fetus or a child. She didn't have a child. But the Gemara in Yevamo says Vatihi Sarah Akara Ein La Valad. What does it mean, she didn't have Valad? What does that word mean? Afilu Beis Valad Ein La. So it means that she didn't even have a repository, a place for a fetus to be housed, meaning she had absence of the uterus, absence of the womb, or absence of the rechem. And the nace of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the obviously not visible to anyone around, was that she was able to have a child with the absence of a womb, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu obviously must have, so to speak, transplanted a womb into her abdomen to facilitate her being able to have a child. There is yet another fascinating midrashic line which relates to the concept of transplantation, at least within the uterus, and that is as follows, and this relates very much to the contemporary discussions about surrogate motherhood. One of the major issues in contemporary halachic literature is the definition of maternity in cases of surrogate motherhood, where one mother provides the genetic material and another mother, another woman, provides the womb, the so-called surrogate mother, or a gestational host is the technical term. And poskim look for precedent in the rabbinic literature for this scenario. And one of the precedents which has been turned to is a fascinating midrashic interpretation of the events that have unfolded in the last few parshios that we have read on Shabbos. And it is the birth of the Shvatim. And according to this medrash briefly, it's a complex medrash, but I'll hopefully convey it briefly. The Leah had given birth to six of the Shvatim. And Bilha and Zilpah each gave birth to two Shvatim. And Leah knew by nevuah, by prophecy, that Yaakov would have a total of 12 sons, a total of 12 Shvatim, a total of 12 tribes. And she also knew that she was pregnant and that she was now pregnant with a male child, which means that she would give birth at this stage to the seventh of the Shvatim, and therefore her sister, on whom she had pity, Rachel, if she would carry another male child, Rachel would only be left with one single shevet. And she would be less in stature even than the maidservants, even than Bilhah and Zilpah. So she prayed to God that there should be a change in the fetus, that the fetus that she was carrying should be... Now, there's two interpretations here. The Gemara has one interpretation, and I'll share with you the interpretation which is relevant for our discussion. According to the Targum Yonasan, which I'll summarize for you, Rachel was simultaneously pregnant with a female child, and Leah was pregnant with a male child, and she prayed that there should be an interuterine exchange between the two fetuses, and that the male child that she was carrying should be transferred to the womb of her sister Rachel, and the female child that Rachel was carrying should be transferred to the womb of Leah. And that's how this midrashic interpretation, and in fact, it explains one interesting, unique aspect of the psukim, because the pasuk says, for every single birth that Leah gives birth to a child of the Shvatim, it says, Vatahar Leah Vatele, Vatahar Vatele, Vatahar Vatele in each one. Vatahar means she conceived a child. Vatele means she gave birth to the child. But when she gives birth to Dina, the Torah says, Ve'achar Yoldabas. And afterwards she gave birth to a daughter. It does not say, Vatahar vateled bas, she conceived and she gave birth to a child, because according to this midrashic interpretation, she did not conceive Dina. It is actually Rachel who conceived Dina. But there was a transfer of the fetuses in utero, so that the fetus was actually born to Leah was Dina, and the fetus which was conceived by Leah, which was Yosef, was actually born to Rachel. There's widespread ramifications of this medrash through many different areas of Tanakh, which would make for itself a fascinating discussion, but not for our discussion today. This brings us forward to the heading, the case of the uterus transplant that never was. And this is really a remarkable case of the importance of learning halachic literature in previous times and its potential impact on discussions today. And what I share with you is a paragraph which appeared in a halachic journal in 1907. And the journal was called Vaylakit Yosef. It was a prominent Hungarian journal. Many of the great rabbinic authorities at that time contributed to that journal. And of course, everything in Hebrew will be translated, so don't fear. Atzia bazesh ela shenistapakti lehalacha. A Rabbi Gordon from England sends a question for forum discussion in a journal called Vaylakit Yosef. And he writes, Harofim himsiu po tachbula lo shiv kleileda me'isha be'isha akara v'alkein tuchal leholid. The doctors today, in this generation, he's talking 1907, have devised a method of transplanting reproductive organs from one woman to another woman, such that the recipient of the organs who was previously infertile is now able to conceive. This is 1907 we're talking about. What questions does he now ask? Im mutter lanu likach haklei leida meha'em velitein behabas. If you're going to do a transplantation, are you allowed to harvest the reproductive organs of the mother and transplant them into the daughter? Vim tim tzalomer de mutter, and if that's the case, that it's permitted to transplant, mahu adin le'inyon bechor, shetalya bepeterechem. And if you are transplanting, as the questioner assumes, you are transplanting not only the ovaries and the fallopian tubes and the uterus and the external genitalia, all of this is assumed to be transplanted by the person that's asking this halachic question. If you're transplanting the womb, what is the halacha for pidyon haben? If you had a woman who had a womb and had her own children, now you're transplanting that womb to somebody else, and this will be her first child. If that's a male child, what is the halachic status of that first male child when the womb already had a pidyon haben? Would you have a pidyon haben from this second womb? Ubichlal mihi ha'em bazeh. And in general, who's the halachic mother of the child from the recipient of this donation? Is it the first mother who gave the ovarian tissue and the reproductive organs? Or is it the second mother? Now this question was asked in 1907. Many people turn to this in the halachic literature and read this and say, this obviously was a hypothetical. This had clearly had no basis in reality. because they weren't doing transplants in 1907. They for sure weren't doing reproductive organ transplants. They for sure weren't transplanting the uterus or the fallopian tubes or the ovaries. But the fact of the matter is, it's not true. And even scientists today are unaware of this fascinating historical chapter, which was basically forgotten about. And the chapter was started with the following case. There was a physician by the name of Robert Tuttle Morris, one of many physicians, by the way. He was an obstetric physician in New York. And at that time, the custom was, and the practice was, to remove the ovaries of many women who suffered from inexplicable abdominal pain. That was the practice, the surgical and OBGYN practice in those days. Now, in retrospect, it probably didn't need to happen, and it probably didn't solve their problems, but that was the practice. So what happened is you had many, many young women who presented with abdominal pain, had their ovaries removed, and were now in menopause, and were now infertile. So this physician had a brilliant idea. So these women who have their ovaries removed, and in retrospect they shouldn't have been removed to begin with, but that's not the issue, why don't I transplant healthy ovarian tissue back into these women to restore their menses and possibly restore their fertility? And this is what he actually did. And in all that period of history, there was one single case of success. And this is that one case, published in 1906, a case of heteroplastic ovarian grafting followed by pregnancy and the delivery of a living child. So basically what he did is he himself had a woman whose ovaries he removed for medical reasons, then went across the hall to another woman who donated ovarian tissue and inserted the piece of ovary into the abdominal cavity of this woman whose ovaries he himself had removed. A year later, this woman gave birth to a healthy child. This is the first case ever of ovarian transplantation. What were the discussions back then? The surgeon himself wrote, "One of my women patients who was something of a wag and who was about to receive an ovarian graft from an operation wanted to know if the donor was a Methodist or an Episcopalian." In a discussion in the journals back in that age, in 1906 when it transpired, Dr. Patterson considered the woman who bore the child acted only as an incubator for the ovum of the other woman. It had been fertilized in the body of the second woman, but the life in the ovum was given to it by the first woman, so that the first woman was the mother of the life of the child. This seemed the biological aspect, and I apologize for this next comment to the women in the audience, but if the portion of ovary had been purchased by the second woman, the question would probably have been a different aspect of law. So these were the discussions back then. And another fascinating one. His opinion was that the woman who supplied the ovary was the mother and the child was a bastard. He held that when a man married a woman, her ovaries belonged to him, and even after they were transferred to another woman, they were still his. So the offspring of the second woman must be a bastard. This is 1906, 1907. What were the topics discussed by the postscheme then? Now here's the fascinating thing which makes it relevant to our discussion and the importance of looking at old halachic literature. The reality of the case was only a small sliver of ovarian tissue was transplanted. The person who asked the question in 1907 to the rabbinic authorities in this Hungarian journal was not familiar with the details of the case. And when he asked the case for the rabbis to discuss, he assumed that not only was the ovarian tissue transplanted, but the uterus was transplanted, the external genitalia were transplanted, the ovarian tissue were transplanted. As a result, from that point, from 1907 in that halachic journal, for literally 20 years, 30 years, rabbis were discussing halachic ramifications of uterus transplantation. And it never occurred. Didn't transpire. What were the discussions that they discussed? And we can turn back to this literature to help reveal what the halachic issues would be about a contemporary uterus transplant. What were the topics discussed? We'll go through these presently. Issue number one, Le'inyan Bechor. We talked about the firstborn. What would be the case if the donor had children with the firstborn? And these are lengthy, serious, halachic discussions based on this mistaken question. What would be the issue if a woman had a uterus transplant and the donor had many children, and now the recipient is having a firstborn male child? Do we have a pidyon haben for that child or not? So listen to the fascinating discussions. So the Gemara in Yevamos says, first of all, they mention Sarah Imenu. We said Sarah had a uterus transplant, right? So here, in a fascinating comment for discussion at a later time, Vatihi Sarah Akara Filu Beis Velad Ein La. So this person who's writing the response says it cannot be that uterus transplants are possible. Why not? Because he says if that's the case, then Sarah, who didn't have a uterus, v'im haya neima de yoel klei leida me'isha acheres in Cain, lo tzarech HaKadosh Baruch Hu la'asos la'neis. If it would have been possible to perform uterus transplants, then God would never have done a miracle. She just could have gone to the doctor and had a uterus transplant. Obviously, there's some fault in that logic, which we're not going to discuss now. But looking at the halachic analysis is fascinating. He mentions the following Gemara. There's a Gemara in Chulin, which has a whole list of wild cases of hypotheticals and whether they generate firstborn status or not. So and I'll just summarize it for you. One of the cases is as follows. Let us say the Gemara says, and the purpose of the Gemara is try to identify what activates the firstborn status. Is it touching the walls of the uterus on exit? Is it touching the walls of the vaginal walls on exit? Is it coming out in the air? What is it that generates the status? So the Gemara asks the following hypothetical question. Let's say, and I'm sure many women would love this to be the case, let's say the fetus floats out and never touches any of the walls at all, and doesn't touch any of the side walls of the entire reproductive tract before it exits. Is that child considered a firstborn or not considered a firstborn? So that what the Gemara is trying to sharpen is really what is it that exactly creates the firstborn status? So the Gemara there says it's a suffix. I don't know. Maybe it creates a firstborn status, maybe it doesn't. So this posek back then in 1907 said the following. This woman has the avir, she has the heir of the rechem. So this is exactly her case. So from her perspective, even if you hold it's not her uterus, which is a matter of debate, at the very least she has the avir harechem. She has the heir, which might confer firstborn status. So maybe this child is a suffix before. Maybe you should do the pidyon haben, you should do the redemption, you should do without a bracha. And these are, by the way, I'm just mentioning highlights. Each one of these cases were discussed in by multiple rabbis with very complex, fascinating discussions. Another discussion was erva. Now this may sound really bizarre, but these are the case, based on the question, this is what they mentioned. We'll see the relevance as we move forward into the 21st century. They assumed that the external reproductive organs were transplanted. So there's clearly, so that's why they asked, what if the transplant is from a mother to a daughter? Now obviously, there is a theoretical concern that in the course of physical contact, the husband might be in contact with someone who would be prohibited for him to have relations with. So it's obviously prohibited for a husband to have relations with the mother of his wife. That's clearly forbidden. 1,000% Isser Erba, that's Arias, that's prohibited. But here, it's just an organ. It's just an organ which has been transplanted and separate from the rest of the body. So here, this is the Ab Bezdin of Bonahad in Hungary at that time, Eliezer Deutsch. And he had a very lengthy halachic analysis, and he said that once the tissue has been extracted, the tissue has been removed, it no longer has any association or identification which with its original source. There would be no prohibition of Isser of Erba. Sirus is rendering someone infertile or castrated. And there is a debate. Now, to render a man as infertile, is it clearly a biblical prohibition? But what about rendering a woman infertile? Is that prohibited or not? And there is a debate amongst rabbinic authorities whether it's permitted or completely forbidden or forbidden according to rabbinic law. So that's another issue they discussed. When you remove the uterus from woman A, is that a violation of castration for that woman by removing her ability to procreate? And the prohibition of chavala, of wounding. And maternity, I think Rabbi Rapport will talk a little bit about maternity. We'll talk about maternity. Great. But just to give you an idea of how this was perpetuated for decades afterwards, these are a couple examples. Remember, the case took place in 1906. The first discussion was in 1907. This is Evan Yekara, Tel Talpiot, Shelos and Shivas Tzur Yaakov over the many decades. 1975, in the late 1970s and 1980s, that Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Waldenberg, all discussed this notion of uterus transplant, all based on this one case which transpired back in 1906 and was perpetuated within the halachic literature. So let's now move to the third section of our talk, and that's modern uterus transplantation. The first successful or semi-successful case of uterus transplantation took place in the year 2001 in Saudi Arabia, of all places. Now, why Saudi Arabia? Because in Saudi Arabia, they're much more restrictive in terms of in vitro fertilization. So they won't allow a woman. Now, you in the modern world will ask, and it's a question which needs to be asked, why should you perform uterus transplantation today? Because any woman who wants to have a child, she can take, and she has her own ovaries, and she has her own eggs, why don't just take those eggs, fertilize it with her husband's reproductive seed, and use a surrogate? Why go through the whole craziness of transplanting a uterus into this woman so she can carry the child? So in Saudi Arabia, the impetus was they don't allow IVF. So since they don't allow IVF, the only way for a woman to carry a child is with uterus transplantation. But even in America, where we allow IVF, what's the impetus for doing it? So the answer is that there still is an intense desire to carry your own child. Enough that people are allowing this kind of transplant to take place. In 2011, so that was a successful case because they transplanted the uterus, but it didn't remain. It only remained for about 100 days. In 2001, there was another case, and there was actually an embryo transfer into that woman, and she became pregnant, but the pregnancy was not successful. Just this past year, in Sweden, they performed 7 uterus transplants. And I highlight this because it's fascinating, because it dates us back to the question from 9 uterus transplants. And just this past year was the very first case ever in the history of mankind to have a success. Now there have been more. I think they're up to six now. of cases that are born. I heard this morning 6, maybe you know more. But the first case ever was back in October 2014 of a child born from uterus transplantation. And interestingly, apropos the original question in the Halachic Journal, in most cases the recipient's mother was the donor. So mutterlitein, from the aim to the bas. It's fascinating because that's exactly what's been happening. The mother's been transplanting into the mother. I credit Dr. Avi Oppenheimer for this photograph. This is actually in the OR when that baby was born, and he knows one of the people that were involved in that case. And you may have seen just last month there was an article in the New York Times which brought it to more popularity. There's a team in Cleveland Clinics which is working actively to perform uterus transplantation here in the United States. So just for the last few moments, I want to share with you what the potential halachic ramifications are for uterus transplant today in the 21st century. First thing we need to do is to contextualize this transplant amongst other transplants. Now, this is not a discussion today about all organ transplants. That itself could take a fair amount of time. But we need to address living donation, which has been discussed in the past in terms of blood, bone marrow, kidneys, livers, lungs, and uterus. And the halachic issue there for the donor specifically is, are you allowed to donate? Are you allowed to take that kind of risk? And especially there's a mitzvah of lo tamod al dam reecha. Rav Shechter Shlita talked about lo samod al dam reecha with respect to disclosure this morning. But lo samod al dam reecha relates to giving an organ to somebody to potentially save their life. And if you're harvesting from the donor perspective, from someone who has died, can you harvest from someone who is brain dead? Which is another, the massive debate in the 20th and 21st century about whether halacha considers brain death to be death and whether you're permitted to harvest or not harvest. But the unique aspect of this transplant is that it is fundamentally different from previous transplants in the last 50 years, which started with kidney transplants. What's the difference? the uterus is not a vital organ. So all the halachic discussions before about living donation, cadaveric donation, relate to kidneys, livers, hearts, lungs. All of those organs are vital for the recipient. If you don't get those organs, you cannot survive without those organs. There is a new frontier of transplants, and that is the frontier of non-vital organ transplants. And here you have a number of the new non-vital organ transplants. This is the most recent. There have been more than a handful of cases now of face transplants. This is the most comprehensive face transplant, just about a few months ago. The hand transplant, now there were double hand transplants already. The voice box, the larynx, has been transplanted. And I often joke, if a man receives a woman's larynx, is that an issue of kol isha or not? What are the unique halachic aspects here for the last few moments? If the donor is a living donor, in this case of uterus transplant, is there a prohibition of wounding, of harming, of sakana? The sakana is relatively modest because we've been much better in terms of containing surgical risk. Some of the issues are the same as discussed back in 1907. Is there an issue of cirrus? Does it render the woman infertile and consequently usser? Now, one of the interesting aspects which make this unique from the donor's perspective is that when you donate a kidney, and which is a tremendous thing to donate kidneys and bone marrow and blood, the recipient is in a state of pikuach nefesh. They're in a state that this will be a life-saving procedure. When you're donating a uterus to somebody, the recipient is healthy. They're infertile, but they're healthy. Can you incur this kind of risk to perform that kind of thing? So that's an aspect which needs to be fleshed out significantly in this topic. What about from the cadaveric donor? Actually, I'm going to skip to this slide. We'll return to the other one. There's one very interesting aspect which affects the Jewish community specifically. So uterus transplants, these women who donated the uterus were not necessarily to their daughters, didn't have any medical issues. But there's a unique aspect which Pua addresses as well, which may make Jewish women specifically more amenable to donating ovaries than others. How do I mean? So I bring for you the article of Angelina Jolie, which many of you may be familiar with. She was found to be BRCA positive, famous actress in Hollywood. Her first procedure that she did years ago was she had a bilateral mastectomy. She removed the breast tissue, and that created waves in the medical community that maybe everyone should remove breast tissue if they're found to be positive for the gene associated with breast cancer. Her second surgery, though, was another very important aspect of the BRCA gene, and that's its association with ovarian cancer. So it is now suggested in certain cases, and admittedly a topic which requires its own lengthy analysis, when and if and how women should be undergoing this procedure. But it may be recommended for some who are high risk for ovarian cancer to undergo ovarian removal. So the question is going to be, for a woman who's undergoing ovarian removal, and she has a daughter who had her uterus taken out for another reason, they're already undergoing the surgery to remove the ovarian tissue, can she say, I want to donate my uterus to my daughter? She's already undergoing the procedure. So you don't have to worry about the serous aspect. She's already having the ovaries removed. You don't have to worry about the wounding, the chavala aspect. She's already having the surgery. So it makes her more amenable. With respect to cadaveric donation, many of the issues would be assimilated or similar to other forms of donation. Does this organ require burial? Is it a desecration of the body? Is it inappropriate deriving benefit from the body? The same issues would be applied to vital organ donation, but in vital organ donation, you're allowed to override the prohibitions and concerns about burial if it's pikuach nefesh, if you're saving the life of the recipient. But in this case, you're not saving the life of the recipient. So can someone say, I want to donate my uterus after death? Will we allow that person to violate the integrity of the body, not to have burial of that organ, and to potentially desecrate the body to harvest that organ for someone who is not in a state of pikuach nefesh as a recipient? What about issues for the recipient? For the recipient, The issue is the risk of the surgery. And here's an interesting aspect unique specifically to uterus transplants. For the recipient, what makes this halakhically problematic is the following. If you need a life-saving procedure, such as a kidney or a liver or a heart, to get transplanted, it's okay for you to take the risk to undergo the surgery. And furthermore, it's okay for you to take the medicine after surgery to suppress your immune system to allow you to retain that organ, because that medication itself is a tremendous risk, because it'll subject you to many illnesses which you wouldn't otherwise be subjected to. Can a woman or anyone who's getting a non-vital organ transplant receive these medications and put them at high risk for a procedure which they don't need? It's not a required procedure. The only added advantage here is that in this scenario, and only in the uterus transplant, not the hand transplant or the larynx transplant or other non-vital transplants, once she has the child, you can remove the uterus. And she will not need to take the immunosuppressive medications in perpetuity for the rest of her life. She can only do it until the child is born. Other fascinating issues are Bechor. We talked about the issue of Bechor. But here's the interesting dimension, is that people who undergo uterus transplants will most assuredly have the baby born by cesarean section and will not have the baby born through natural delivery. As a result, there'll be no question about pidyon haben because the child won't be born naturally, and cesarean section precludes that. One fascinating aspect, which I haven't seen anyone address, and I'm curious if it becomes a reality, how it's going to be addressed, is the issue of nida. The halachic aspects of nida. One of the prerequisites or requirements of nida, or at least the biblical prohibition of nida, is that the woman has to sense the dam bivsara. She has to sense the blood in her flesh, which it's a debate exactly how it's applied or not applied, but has important halachic ramifications. And it's quite possible that a woman who didn't have a uterus, never had menstrual flow, was never had a status of nida, will now get a uterus transplant, will begin to have menstrual flow, will now be subjected to the issues that relate to nida, but it's not bivsara, it's not her flesh, it's not her physical body. She won't even be able to sense it neurologically because it's not connected to her nervous system. So I'm curious if that'll have any impact on the. It's just a hypothetical. And finally, for the last few moments, just to share with you some other potential uses of uterus transplantation. Here you have the cartoon. The uterus transplant was a success. I'm sure you'll find your husband much more understanding now. But this remains a hypothetical, but will clearly be explored further in the near future, is that if it's possible to transplant the uterus into a woman that has no uterus, will it be possible to transplant the uterus into a man? So I'm sure many of you are familiar with Caitlyn Jenner. It was just announced yesterday or the day before that she is the most fascinating person of 2015. The concept of transgender, now the halachic world is dealing with the issue of transgender. The question is, will this be a halachic discussion about people undergoing transgender surgeries? Can they undergo uterus transplants? And what's going to be the status of the people who undergo it and the children that are born through it? There is an entire sefer on gender reassignment called Sefer Dor Tapuchos. As of yet, it does not have a chapter on uterine transplantation. Will its next edition, that comes out in a year or two from now, have to add an additional chapter that discusses the issue of uterus transplantation in the male? I apologize for not having the time to flesh out all these issues. There are many fascinating issues, and perhaps we can discuss after a rapport in the Q&A. But in short, we've had an opportunity to discuss uterus transplantation from the times of Tanakh through the chapter in 1907 that never was, but Baruch Hashem gives us a wealth of halachic discussions and literature about cases of uterine transplantation, which now today, the uterus transplantation has become a reality, we can now apply for the modern circumstance. Thank you so much.